the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising and I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's Friday, August 28th, 2015. Former Symbionese Liberation Army member James Kilgore joins us. He's now a professor and he's written a new book called Understanding Mass Incarceration, A People's Guide to the Key Civil Rights Struggle of Our Time. And we'll explore the sordid history of U.S. national parks. It involves the displacement of Native American tribes. Plus, Ugandan activist Bukenya Musa joins us in studio to share his model of grassroots empowerment and human rights work. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Christina Mislan. She's an assistant professor of journalism studies at the Missouri School of Journalism. Hi, Christina.
Hello, Sonali.
An abandoned truck found on a European highway filled with the bodies of migrants has once more brought the crisis of migration to the fore. 71 bodies were found, likely of Syrian origin, inside a truck on a highway between Hungary and Austria. Among the dead were 60 men, 8 women, and 3 very young children. They likely suffocated in the locked truck. A Bulgarian man connected with the truck has been arrested. The horrific news came on the same day as many as 200 people died in the Mediterranean Sea when a boat sank off of the coast of Libya. About 400 people had boarded that boat. Some 3,000 migrants were rescued by Swedish ship and Italian coast guardsmen separately. Well, Christina, war-torn Middle Eastern and African nations seem to be just hemorrhaging people. Do you think that this migrant crisis could force Europe to examine both its foreign policies and immigration policies?
Well, we know that European countries have been saying for quite a while now that they're going to re-examine their policies. And that was months ago. We've been dealing, Europe has been dealing with this, although the United States has its own immigration issues as well. But Europe has been dealing with this for this past year. The issue of migrants dying overseas then has been occurring for way too long now. And as one of their solutions, they put in place an operation that really served kind of like as a taxi service where border patrol agents would pick up refugees being carried by smugglers on boats. But that doesn't obviously seem to be stopping the number of people who are dying trying to get to Europe. So there obviously must be more. And some policy experts are suggesting that Europe should maybe look to US for some ideas. But as I just mentioned, I'm not sure that's the best idea, as we're dealing with our own anti-immigration policies. And we're also part of the problem as well, US foreign policy, that being the case. But maybe implementing programs where refugees could actually attain asylum before leaving home, where Europe would actually be responsible for making sure that people could get to Europe safely.
Here in the United States, the National Labor Relations Board, or NLRB, has just struck a major blow to the corporate fast food industry. Companies like McDonald's had long protected themselves against being held accountable for labor violations, saying that that was the responsibility of the franchise owners. But in a 3-2 decision, the NLRB ruled that workers could hold parent companies liable for violations. The ruling is extremely significant in that unions could now negotiate directly with a handful of major companies instead of having to contend with thousands of smaller franchise owners. It also means that franchise owners may not necessarily be responsible when carrying out directives from parent companies that impact its workers. Unions like SEIU and the Teamsters celebrated the ruling. Millions of American workers are employed by franchises. Christina, do you see this as a huge legal victory that unions could take serious advantage of?
Yeah, there definitely is a huge advantage for unions here. Now, maybe we could take this advantage and apply it elsewhere. For instance, there are many other institutions where the notions of employment need to be redefined so that various types of workers could be protected. Now, remember, though, for a while now, I mean, unions are still illegal in some states. And if we look at some of the latest stats, approximately about 11.8% of American workers are actually union members. And in the private sector, that's just 6.9%. So we still have a long way to go, but this is definitely, hopefully, a beginning to that.
And finally, a major tropical storm has hit the Caribbean island of Dominica and is headed toward Florida. In Dominica, 4 people were killed when the storm caused major mudslides. Erica is now unfolding in Puerto Rico, where major rains are hitting the island hard. It could hit Florida over the weekend or by Monday as a hurricane. The National Weather Service and other forecasters are confused about the storm's direction when its center started wobbling yesterday. which made it hard to forecast. Florida Governor Rick Scott said the storm posed a, quote, severe threat to the entire state. He's declared a state of emergency. This week marks the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, which devastated New Orleans, killing thousands and displacing hundreds of thousands. Well, Christina, Governor Rick Scott is a vehement climate change denier. He's even unofficially banned the use of the terms climate change and global warming in his presence. Do you see some major irony here?
Well, I'm not sure if it's irony. I think it's just interest at stake. And so, for instance, and I'll relate this, we can maybe think about Louisiana's Governor Bobby Jindal and this 10-year anniversary on Katrina. He recently just wrote a letter to President Obama before Obama went to New Orleans to speak, to say that President Obama should not say or politicize anything about climate change, et cetera, in his speech. Now, here's the thing is that Bobby Jindal is funded by the energy companies. I mean, he has a plant right outside of his estate in Louisiana. The same thing goes for someone like Governor Rick Scott. Rick Scott has been funded politically by energy companies. So again, a lot of times when politicians are seen as these climate change deniers, I think we actually really need to start looking at, really, is it that they're deniers or their interests are not our interests?
Christina, thank you as always for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you.
Christina Mislan is our daily Newsflash guest expert. She's an assistant professor of journalism studies at the Missouri School of Journalism. This is Uprising. And by the way, you can check out my latest column at truthdig.com, where I write about a lot of the stories that you hear on the air. This week, I wrote about Amazon, Amazon.com's workplace problems. Again, that's at truthdig.com. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. The United States imprisons more people than anyone else in the world, hands down. Not only is it the absolute number of people we imprison greater than any other nation, but we also lead in the percentage of our population that we lock up. These are shameful facts behind which lie many complex factors. And exploring those factors in a new book is James Kilgore. Kilgore knows a thing or two about prisons. He spent several years behind bars for his radical political activism in the 1970s via his membership in the Symbionese Liberation Army, or SLA. The SLA, as you may recall, was involved in the famed kidnapping of heiress Patty Hearst in 1974. Here is how a CBS News article described Kilgore's story. Quote, the Oregon native survived the 1974 shootout between the SLA and police in Los Angeles, in which six SLA members died. He disappeared in 1975. After more than 25 years on the run, U.S. federal marshals arrested Kilgore in South Africa, where he'd been living under an assumed name. He was extradited to the United States and later sentenced to 6 years in a prison. Well, James Kilgore is now an adjunct instructor of global studies and urban planning at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. His book is called Understanding Mass Incarceration, A People's Guide to the Key Civil Rights Struggle of Our Time. He now joins me live on the program. Welcome to Uprising.
Good morning, Sonali. Nice to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Well, you have quite a story, but your book focuses on the nitty-gritty of incarceration. Did your personal experience on the inside influence your book and become a factor in its uniqueness? We have books about mass incarceration, but I'm not sure how many have been written by somebody who spent 6 years themselves behind bars.
Absolutely. My prison experience shaped this book. During that 6.5 years, I saw an endless stream of black, brown, and poor white bodies coming through those prison gates. And most of them were serving incredible sentences, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, life, life without parole, double life. I had one friend who was doing 555 years. And when I found out their stories, the crimes that they had been convicted of, I couldn't quite figure out how that connected to the level of punishment that they were receiving. So this prompted me when I was released from prison in 2009 to investigate this thing, which I later found was called mass incarceration. And I became an activist in my own community around these issues, opposing a jail project in my county of Champaign County, Illinois. But also I began to research and write because I'd been a researcher and an educator, a popular educator before I was incarcerated. And I thought that there was a need for a book that described mass incarceration broadly from Obama to Clinton to Reagan, from the war on immigrants to the war on drugs, but did it in an accessible way using the voices of people who were directly impacted. So that's how I set out to undertake this project of writing a book about which I've called the key civil rights struggle of our era.
And in fact, on that specific phrase that you use, how much of that has to do with the fact that this system that we have in the United States impacts the poor and specifically people of color most so? Does that fact highlight that not only is this a system that's insidious in how many people it brings into its dragnet, but that it targets vulnerable ones?
Absolutely. As many people know through the writings of Michelle Alexander and others, the African-American population in prisons and jails is about 40%, more than double their rate in the general population. In the state where I live, in Illinois, African-Americans make up 15% of the general population, 58% of those in prison. But I think it's also important to recognize that mass incarceration is not simply about locking people up, but that it's an approach to how we deal with poverty, how we deal with poor people's problems. Instead of providing welfare support, social services, instead of allocating resources into those communities, we've chosen to punish poverty, to punish the poor, with the direct result that a disproportionate amount of the prison population is people of color, and the communities that they come from have been devastated by the loss of those people to prisons and jails, and also by the policing activities that have been taking place there, largely as a result of the war on drugs and more recently wars on immigrants.
And I want to get to those two wars in particular and how casting them as wars is crucial. The prison population, however, didn't sort of balloon in a vacuum. It grew. It wasn't just politicians who've pushed this, right? It's grown with the permission of at least some sectors of U.S. society.
Absolutely. But I think there's been a concerted effort to create a public mindset to generate a fear of crime, a fear of the criminals. And the media has played a big role in this. If you look at the increased coverage of crime stories on local news from the 1970s to the 1990s, we know now that if it bleeds, it leads. And almost every night, if you look at that local news, you're going to see a crime story, sometimes quite a minor story, leading rather than much more important events that are taking place elsewhere. And then we had the creation of these kind of media figures who became emblematic of the criminal. We had the case of Willie Horton in 1988, who was released from prison on a furlough program and then committed some crimes on that furlough, some violent crimes while on furlough, but he had been released by Michael Dukakis, who was the governor of Massachusetts at the time, who was campaigning for president. And George Bush used the image of Willie Horton against Michael Dukakis in a successful run to gain the presidency. Similar on the female side, we had the creation of the Welfare Queen by Ronald Reagan, casting African-American women in particular as those who were living off welfare checks in multiple identities, driving Cadillacs, living in five-story mansions, et cetera, all off the taxpayer dollar. And this was calculated to raise the ire of, in particular, socially conservative white voters who were upset at the fact that somehow their tax dollars were being misused by these kinds of people.
Now, one of the powerful statements you make about how racism permits mass incarceration is, quote, "Blacks are the repository for the American fear of crime." I thought that was a really eloquent and very powerful statement. Can you expand on that a little bit? I mean, you just did it to an extent, but also when it comes to interactions between police and African Americans, that statement in particular becomes crucial.
Well, certainly we've seen the reactions of police to African Americans in the recent cases in Sandra Bland, Sam Dubose, and so forth, where we've had very vivid video coverage of what are really everyday kinds of events, that the ones that we've seen are the ones that have gone horribly wrong. But on a day-to-day basis, we're seeing these kinds of encounters where there's an assumption when a person is driving while black that they're up to no good, and that they're subject to search, to all kinds of unreasonable requests, and in many cases physical abuse, even to the point of death. And if we look at the stop and frisk policies in New York, if we look at cases, studies of racial profiling of traffic stops in Minneapolis, and even in the town where I live, in Urbana, Illinois, we find that there's a disproportionate number of African-American drivers who are pulled over, even though the evidence shows they're less likely to be to have contraband in their cars than similarly profiled white drivers.
How serious a role has money played in the expansion of the prison industrial complex? Imprisonment is supposed to be a government affair, but today many prisons and detention centers are run by for-profit corporations, which means that the more people we imprison, the more money these companies make, and that is just a perversion.
Absolutely. I like to describe the prison industrial complex as a public-private partnership. And I think in some circles, there's a tendency to blame all of this, for example, on the private prison operators. But really, private prisons only control about 9% of the prison beds in the United States. So they, in some senses, are a minor player. Hmm. And there's a much broader range of corporate interests that kind of get off the hook in terms of making the profits from this system. So we have construction companies, we have even major finance houses like Goldman Sachs have been involved in underwriting the bonds that were used to build a whole array of prisons in California in the 1990s. And then we have the service providers in prison, companies like Securus Technologies that made $114 million last year off of prison phone calls. We have Aramark Food Corporation. We have Corizon Health Services. All of these are feeding at the trough of the budgets of mass incarceration. And it's a big economic project, but underlying it is a political project about how we solve problems of poverty, homelessness, mental health, substance abuse, et cetera. And that's where the public sector comes in, and where the change in the state from a state that focused on providing at least some semblance of a social safety net to a state whose main task seems to be providing profit opportunities for private corporations and pushing security.
And of course, at the heart of all of these stories is the fact that there are living, breathing fellow Americans, human beings, in some cases immigrants, existing behind bars. And one of the things that sets your books apart from this on this subject is that occasionally you include poetry. You have even a section on music from the prison system. And I like this poem that you put in your book by a lifer named Joseph Dole. I just want to read for my audience a couple of paragraphs of stanzas of this. It's called American Supermax. A guard informed me upon arrival that there are benefits to this isolation. He promoted the fact that we are now all safe from gang retaliation. I had to ask, but what of the retaliation of the prison administration? He smiled cryptically as he enjoyed this in ecstatic contemplation. Several more stanzas, but I thought that was really powerful. Why did you include this?
Well, I think it's really important in terms of building a social movement to resist, to overturn, to destroy mass incarceration, that people who have been incarcerated, who are incarcerated, and their families and communities are playing a leading role in this, and we hear their voices. We have lots of academic studies, and these are very important, but we need to also include the voices of those who have been locked up. They have a different perspective, and as well as their families, their children, their partners, and so forth. And there's kind of a stereotype that people have about people who are incarcerated. Somehow they think that when we're in prison, we sit in our cell all day depressed, kind of looking out a window at a gray wall or something. But prisons have their own ways of developing activities, of developing forms of resistance. And even if we're not at all times seeing people doing heroic actions, doing hunger strikes, doing other kinds of activities, on a day-to-day basis, people find ways to resist the authority of the administration, to resist the dehumanization of being incarcerated. And one of the ways people do this is by writing. So that's why I've included the works of Joseph Dole, for example, because he's written many, many poems, but he's also written an entire book doing a life sentence in the Illinois state prison system. He's written an entire book about mass incarceration in the prison system. So these are critical voices. And I think organizations like All of Us or None, organizations like A New Way of Life in Los Angeles have played a big role in bringing out those voices.
Now, I want to go back to what you brought up earlier, which is that there are many aspects to why people get fed into the prison system. The war on drugs is one that we talk about a lot. There's also the war on immigrants, which has become a sort of a new feeder into the prison system. It's been around for a long time, but it's been expanded quite a bit. Why does putting these issues into the context of war make sense?
Well, because I think we're attacking these problems as if we're fighting a foreign enemy. I mean, we're attacking them with border patrols. We're attacking them with security walls. We could call those high security fences, the same kinds of things that we put around prisons. So the major thrust of this has been a law enforcement thrust around dealing with immigration. And I think it's important to recognize that while I've talked about how the private prisons don't control a huge sector of the prison and jail system, they do play a very important role in immigration. Immigration has become the cash cow for corporations like the Corrections Corporations of America and the GEO Group, the major players who hold about 40% of the immigration detention cells and are constantly hiring lobbyists and so forth to press for harsher immigration laws in order to expand their market base. So this is a particular area where immigrants' rights activists have focused on these private prisons because they can see that this is one of the areas where they've really succeeded in carving out a market niche and growing it. And since 2010, since the year 2000, we've seen in particular that the percentage of people locked up who are Latino has grown dramatically.
And you have a whole section in your book on women called The Gendered Threads of Punishment, focusing on the women whose loved ones are in prison, but then on women prisoners themselves. But something like 90% of all people in prison in the U.S. are men. Why is it important to look at the gendered side of this?
Well, although 90% of the people in prison may be men, they leave behind families, largely led by women, mothers, grandmothers, sisters, partners and so forth, children, and these families have to cope with the difficulty of having an incarcerated loved one. First of all, in many cases, it removes a major source of financial support. There's the emotional and the parenting duties that those left behind need to carry out in a situation where the kinds of social services and welfare benefits are being reduced. And then there's also the extra burden of just supporting someone directly when they're incarcerated. Prison phone calls have become hugely expensive. There's campaigns against that now. But when I was in prison, I was paying $1 a minute for a phone call. Some places they pay even more than that. Most of our prisons in many states are sited in remote rural areas, which are a long journey from the urban areas where the majority of people who are incarcerated live. So visiting becomes a major expense. All of these kinds of things add up to a tremendous collateral consequence of mass incarceration that's often neglected, largely, I believe, because of a gender bias,
right,
that we don't really see these issues in a complex way including a gender lens.
Finally, James, the whole premise of prisons is supposed to be rehabilitation, and clearly we've come very, very far away from that. You end your book discussing the concepts of restorative justice, taking your cue from a lot of local organizations around the country that have begun to try to change the conversation on prisons. Can you end with giving us some ideas that you lay out in your book on how the prison system needs to desperately be reformed?
Well, there's the reform within the prison to re-inject some kind of ethos of rehabilitation in the prison. But I don't think that should be our major focus. Our major focus needs to be on measures that keep people from going to prison and then get more people out of prison. So changing the approach, changing the mindset is key. We need to get away from this notion that we have to punish people and punish people to the extreme for harm done or wrongs they may have committed. Restorative justice takes a step in that direction by getting people to look toward solutions that don't involve incarceration, that may involve dialogue between people, say in the case of an assault or the case of a household robbery. The idea of restorative justice is to get the people who are involved in that together to talk about why it happened and see if some kind of compensation might be able to be paid rather than having someone be incarcerated. But I think more important is the notion of transformative justice, which says that not only do we need to do those restorative practices, but we need to dig deeper and find out what is the cause of why we're locking people up and transform that system, because it's the system that's locking people up. It's the system of laws, the system of policing, and the social welfare system that's operating under a punitive basis that needs to be transformed in order to stop that flow of bodies into the prisons.
James, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Best of luck to you with your book.
Thank you very much, Sonali. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
My guest is James Kilgore. He is an adjunct instructor of global studies and urban planning at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And we've been discussing his book, Understanding Mass Incarceration, A People's Guide to the Key Civil Rights Struggle of Our Time. He spent 6 years in prison himself because of his role in the Symbionese Liberation Army. You can look up his story online. James Kilgore is his name, K-I-L-G-O-R-E. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. An organization known as Survival International has launched a campaign criticizing conservation efforts in the U.S. and abroad. On the surface, this sounds extremely regressive, but the campaign, dubbed Stop the Con, makes the case that conservation efforts like national parks and nature reserves are often built on the violent displacement of indigenous communities that called those spaces their homes. Take Yosemite, for example. In 1851, California soldiers came across the land that is now a famed tourist destination and kicked out the Awanichi tribe. The displacement that wrapped up as recently as 1969 erased the history of indigenous people in that region and whitewashed the idea of conservation. Writing about the campaign in the Huffington Post the week that the National Park Service turned 99 years old is my guest, Julian Brave Noisecat. He is the Native Issues Fellow at the Huffington Post and a member of the Kanim Lake Band Tequesqueson in British Columbia, where he was nominated to run for chief in 2014. He recently wrote the piece, The Forgotten History of Violent Displacement, that helped create the national parks. Welcome to Uprising, Julian.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I'm so sorry I mispronounced that word. Can you say it for me on the air so everyone can hear?
It's Tequesqueson.
Thank you very much. Okay, so how did the Stop the Con campaign begin? A woman named Tessia Bobricki carried out a major stunt at Yosemite and videotaped herself doing it. What is her motivation?
So the Stop the Con campaign began 2 weeks ago when, as you said, Tasia Bobricki, an environmental activist from California, scaled El Capitan in Yosemite National Park and dangled from a rope 3,000 feet above the valley floor. You can watch a video of the stunt in my article, and the clip can also be found on YouTube. Her motivation was to expose the quote-unquote con of conservation, that is the violent displacement of indigenous peoples in the name of conservation.
And often we think of development as displacing indigenous peoples, not conservation. You brought up in your article, and I briefly mentioned it, the history of a park like Yosemite, which is the site of Tessia's PR stunt to launch this campaign. Do most national parks in the U.S. have a similar history as Yosemite?
Well, it is really the history of the U.S. no matter where you are.
Right.
In order for the United States to be founded, indigenous peoples everywhere had to be killed and displaced. But to specifically address your question, yes, many national parks have this history. Yellowstone, another park, for example, was under the care of the U.S. Army from 1886 to 1918 in order to keep out indigenous peoples and poor settlers who lived in the area.
And staying on Yosemite for a little bit, I very briefly mentioned the tribe that was kicked out. But initially, of course, they were pushed out, but then they returned to take on roles that were essentially servicing people who visited the park, mostly white Americans at that time. And can you go a little bit deeper into that history?
Yeah, so in Yosemite, the Awanichi Indians, as they were called and as they called themselves, worked for years, all the way until actually 1969, to give a sense for how recent this history really is, as performers sort of performing fun in sort of a really messed up way. They actually had to perform as Plains Indians because that's the idea about what Indians were supposed to be that tourists had.
They had to and perform, so they, meaning perform for people who were there?
Yeah, so they did dances and they did sort of like Wild West show type
wow.
things. And they did that so that they could keep living in the park, which had always been their homeland. And they were finally evicted in 1969, and their homes unceremoniously burned down in a firefighting drill by the Park Service.
Now, there have been historians that have uncovered this history, and I want to get to that. But most of the history that we read in our school books, and even, you know, the pamphlets that we get when we visit these parks, don't really tell the story well enough or at all. The story, for example, of John Muir is very sanitized. And we hear this romantic story of how his conservationist ideals helped preserve spaces like Yosemite. And so, you know, do you see that there's been a concerted effort to not really face this history?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned pamphlets and school textbooks, but even recently, Ken Burns' celebrated documentary on the national parks, which called them America's Best Idea, completely ignored this history, even though the scholarship was out there.
So let's talk about some of the historians that you write about. You mentioned several in your article, William Cronin, Mark Spence, Carl Jacoby. How have they dug into this history and how has it been received? Have they broken into the mainstream or have they sort of ruffled feathers?
So unfortunately, I would say that we live in a time when public spaces like the national parks are under attack by the political right. And this history doesn't fit well into the moral fables that, you know, sort of go along partisan lines. And so environmental circles who feel under attack haven't been very receptive to these historians' work. I think that's really too bad, because looking at the history allows us to see ways in which public management of spaces like the national parks, which are undoubtedly beautiful and need to be preserved, could be improved.
Now, is it a Western notion, Julian, for us to look at conservation of nature as these uninhabited spaces that we preserve outside of our living spaces and separate from them? Is this history telling us that we need to change the way we approach conservation, you know, from the ground up, and the ties that indigenous communities have to the land they occupy and that they've lived on for centuries?
Yeah, so I think conservation is absolutely a Western notion, but I think calling it a Western notion isn't specific enough. As Carl Jacobi points out in his outstanding book, Crimes Against Nature, conservation is specifically an upper class idea that comes from the late 19th and early 20th century elite on the East Coast, people like John Muir, Teddy Roosevelt, et cetera, people who write these sort of travelogues and have the kind of money to do that thing. And conservation did target indigenous people's removal, but it also targeted the rural poor. So it meant keeping out all the people who had been living in these parks.
Now, you mentioned earlier the history of the United States is the history of national parks. So let's talk a little bit more about that. The U.S. national parks history does fit within the broader history of colonization of the U.S., the genocide of Native Americans. And yet we, you know, don't really think about that when we visit national parks, for example, when we celebrate, which, you know, certainly we should be happy that there are spaces that haven't been developed by corporations or, you know, completely allowed to languish by the right wing. But how important is it for us to set the history of national parks within the broader history of U.S. colonization?
So far from taking place, I think, in the deep past on some faraway frontier or on rural Indian reservations that are hidden from the public eye and that we never hear about, I think that the history of colonization and settlement is everywhere, and it's inescapable. And I think that that's really the point that I was trying to drive home subtly with this sort of history about this piece about the national parks, because, you know, everybody takes road trips to these places. You know, everybody has their memories of them. But what people don't realize often is that this was all Indian land. It was a place where indigenous peoples buried their ancestors, worshiped their creator, and lived for millennia.
Do we see the process of conservation as it had played out in the U.S. playing out elsewhere in the world today, where indigenous communities are driven out in order to preserve spaces for tourists, etc.? And, you know, it's okay for tigers or lions to inhabit them, but not people?
Yeah, so, I mean, like everything American, the model of conservation that Survival International is critiquing and that these scholars have studied has been exported elsewhere, and according to Survival International, places like Cameroon, Botswana, and India are currently practicing this conservation as displacing the indigenous peoples model.
So what is Survival International's goal with their Stop the Con campaign? Are they trying to change the minds of conservationists? What would be the way to approach these issues?
So Survival International wants to start a public debate. So, you know, hopefully having me on the show today helps continue that conversation. And I think that what they kind of want to strive for primarily is the inclusion of indigenous peoples as stewards and managers of these public spaces. Mm-hmm. I think that that's their primary aim, but they want to start by starting this conversation.
And we will post a link to their website, survivalinternational.org, later today on our website, as well as a link to your article, Julian, at uprisingwithsonali.com. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
My guest is Julian Brave Noisecat, and he is the Native Issues Fellow at the Huffington Post. He is also the author of a new article called The Forgotten History of Violent Displacement That Helped Create the National Parks. This week, U.S. National Park Service turned 99 years old. This is Uprising. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Uganda is a relatively small landlocked country in East Africa bordering Kenya, South Sudan, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. For decades, the country has been ruled formally by President Yoweri Museveni, informally by the Terror of the Lord's Resistance Army, or LRA. Some years ago, a U.S. government-backed campaign to capture Joseph Kony, the leader of the LRA, captivated Americans. Now that the focus on Kony has waned, little about Uganda makes the news. Although the war formally ended in 2006, the LRA persists. But ordinary people in northern Uganda, from where the LRA emerged, are taking matters into their own hands. My guest, Bukenya Musa, is the founder and director of an organization in northern Uganda called Volunteer Action Network. He now joins me in studio. Welcome to Uprising, Bukenya.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Yeah. Now, let's talk about, I want to discuss the politics of Uganda before we get to the work that you do. Just to set the stage for our audience, I mentioned the Lord's Resistance Army and gave a brief overview, but how active is the LRA right now?
LRA right now is not very active in the region, like in northern Uganda. It's pushed away to Central Africa, actually. So northern Uganda region now is in a state of rebuilding, like state of trying to get back into their homes, leaving the internally displaced camps. And yeah, it's relatively safe. You can't hear bullets on the streets, but people are not yet settled inside them. They still think Kony at one point of time will come back and, you know, and destabilize them.
Yeah. So there's still a fear that the LRA will return, because there hasn't been a sort of a formal end to, I mean, there were supposed to be two peace talks in 2006. Some people still treat 2006 as the formal end of that war, but it's not really fully ended and there's still fear.
Yeah, exactly. It's still a lot of fear, and that is exhibited from, you see, people fear to go and stay in their villages. They much more prefer to be in, like, in the town centers, thinking something can happen at any time.
What about the government and the presidency of Yoweri Museveni? He is seen as a major figure in the African Union. The U.S. relies on him, but he's ruled well past his term. How have his policies impacted ordinary people in Uganda?
The policies are very, very appealing, actually, and I think it's the general problem, like leaders overstaying in power. You know. Personally, I'm just going to be clocking 30 years in a few months. Like in November,
he'll have completed 30 years as a president.
Yeah, I've never seen any other president, so
he's
the only president that
he's the only president you've ever known.
Exactly, and. And so with that, it has corrupted all the systems in place, and it's not helping the local population.
And so local populations don't have much of a reliance on the government.
Actually, it is so deeply entrenched. Like politics is full of tokenism right now. It has made
tokenism.
Yeah, people. It has made people to be so impoverished, and he just rigs his way out by use of state resources and. He always gets re-erected back, but...
Well, recently he signed, and his government signed an agreement with Kenya to build an oil pipeline through Kenya's north. And this was months in the works. And often this has been a major problem in impoverished African nations, where natural resources are what companies, outside companies, come in to take advantage of. And they can do that because of corrupt leaders.
Yeah, actually, that is happening a lot. There is a lot of growing wave of seeing that East Africa, the whole East Africa, Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda have like a common market, have the East African common market. And all that is about just, you know, tapping into the new, you know, resources, which is oil in Uganda. That is to benefit like the politicians. Yes. The people, there is no much education around it, what is going to happen. There's a lot of land conflicts, you know, like the government is just grabbing the land and giving it away, giving deals to multinational companies. There's no compensations of the people who have been inhabiting on those lands and all that. So, and there's a lot of little infrastructure development in terms of lands that are heading to those area-rich areas. And of course, those kind of development are targeted just to siphon away the oils. Like, for example, it would be pretty very good if we're going to have a refinery in Uganda to create, like, you know, employment. It would have, you know, lessen the cost of oil, but the refinery which is going to be pushed away from Uganda to Kenya is to ship the crude oil to Mombasa, and then it will be shipped away. In return, we'll get it back at a
much higher rate,
which will not, you know, help. Yeah.
So let's talk about what ordinary people have been doing in Uganda, because, of course, there's little reliance on the government, and there's still fear from groups like the LRA. Tell me about your work, but also specifically tell me about the fact that the work you've done has been focused on women and women's rights.
Yeah.
How did you get to where you are at in terms of seeing women's empowerment and women's work as important?
Yeah, actually, you know, if you could go in statistics of Uganda, you know, you find like almost 49% live in chronic poverty, you know, but if you could get the percentage of the 49, like almost 60% of them are women. And the cultural beliefs in Uganda, the government, you know, policies doesn't favor women. You'll find that girl child education is very low. So
girls'
find
education?
That, yeah, so you'll find that few women have gone
literacy
into
rates
education.
Are very low. Yeah.
They're very low. And then with that trickles in the way how they will, you know, get into business and the way how they will participate into like planning processes or making decisions in the community.
Yeah, worldwide, so, girls and women's education seems to always correlate with their their rights, their ability to lift themselves up, and their autonomy.
Yeah.
And so often that's something that's talked about a lot, but not much is done. So how does your organization, Volunteer Action Network, how did you get involved in it and started and aim it towards women?
Yeah, I actually personally, you know, have passionate about that because my mother, I died. I never had the mother alive. You know, I lost her to almost 6 years when I was very young.
You were six when she.
Yeah, when she died, and she died in my presence. You know, and that it was just about domestic violence. You know, my stepdad coming and fighting every day, asking for food when he's drunk, and then on a fateful day, she kicked my mom badly, and my mom died. And when I grew up after school, you know, I started asking questions. Why would my mom be beaten every day? And she can't question. She can't go away. She can't do everything. So I started to see my mom never went to school. My mom, she's a housewife, you know. She never had any business activity that she's doing. And then I started to say, maybe if she had a little bit of education, she would, you know, be a little
she
bit
would have
self-aware.
Known her rights
yeah,
a
and,
little bit more.
Yeah, and
might have been able to do something.
Exactly,
to save
and
herself.
And it, the most you know apparent things that there was no this gentleman was not held accountable for that, and so because maybe she's not engaged into economic activities, you know, and
so she was financially dependent,
dependent on
him, which
on
is of course the case.
Exactly,
this is a universal story of domestic
exactly,
violence.
Exactly. So and the. And then that has to spark, you know, me to see that I do something. And that's how I said, okay, we need to figure out something that really can change this. And I thought that having a model that combining microcredit education and social programming can be a good fit to address the systematic inequalities around women.
And absolutely, these are not radical solutions. It's not mysterious how one goes about addressing the problems of society.
Yeah.
Tell us about the microcredit, the microloans, which is now a popular model in many poor countries where women are given small loans to learn a trade and start their own business. How is it implemented in northern Uganda, and how well has it worked?
Yeah, actually, you know, fortunately enough, like in our communities, we still have what we call community. It might not be existing very much in the Western context, but but people are so much depending on one another.
Right.
People trust one another. So, and In the fact that people are so poor, so they don't have collaterals, you know.
They don't have?
Collaterals, you know, they don't have anything that they will take in the bank as security to get loans. So using social collateral, women coming together and guaranteeing themselves is one of ways how they can work together.
So they are accountable to one another, exactly. Because they have deep community ties.
Exactly. So and that is one way of how we, you know, penetrate in working with them, using a group methodology model where they can co-guarantee each other, and making sure that it's not just about giving them money to start business, but to train them on how to use that money and how to save it and how to reinvest that money.
So that they're independent.
Yes,
they don't
exactly.
have to rely on either the government or a foreign corporation coming in and handing out jobs and then taking them away or not paying them very well.
Exactly. And our big role is to support self-reliance, actually. You know, to have them, you know, have their own businesses and, you know, have their own representation. It is very, very interesting that for the last 8 years that we've been doing that, we have had women that have moved away from being just a street vendor selling just tomatoes and then making restaurants. And then we have had a shift of 5 women joining elective politics and they are representative at a district level.
Wow. So they're not just starting enterprises,
exactly.
They're entering politics.
Yeah, exactly. When their economic status goes up, they vie for that, and that creates a whole spiral of they're going to be representing views and, you know, we'll have the policies
changed. So it can trickle up to democratic, real grassroots democracy.
Exactly,
wow.
Yeah.
Now, there are so many challenges when poverty is rampant. There's a major malaria epidemic in northern Uganda, which the Ministry of Health announced in July. You need public health infrastructure. You still need infrastructure from government. How do you meet that challenge?
Actually, it is really very, very, very hard, you know, because we have the government per se tries as what it can, and it holds, you know, people captives. It's like, you know, because of the low levels of education, high level of literacy, people don't know their rights, that the government has a responsibility to provide. So the government there, when to provides that, it's like, you know, you must vote well. We've had our
they use it as a way
exactly.
to get political support.
Exactly. We've had our president so much when, you know, when people stand up to, you know, to ask questions about infrastructure, about public health and all that issue, says, okay, next time if you vote very well, things will be in there. Right now, we are seeing a lot of infrastructure from kind of roads spawning, and then they're just using it because months to come, 6 months in February, we'll be going into another election, and they will say, we have made roads for you, so you need to keep us in power.
Now, the openings that Americans and certain types of Americans see in Uganda are also problematic because there's still such a dire need for services. Evangelical Christians from the United States have often found their way to Uganda and places like Uganda, set up centers where they feel like they're saving, particularly children. What do you make of that? You can be honest.
on this program. Yeah, well, it is good that they come to save, but I think it's important to build self-reliance and self-determination in Africa. That thing has for a long time been eroded away, and that is the pride that most of Africans lost to have that, you know, there's so much thinking on the dependency syndrome, you know, always thinking of a savior to come and you solve your own problem, and that whole thing trickles into that. I think
so. It trickles into that public consciousness.
Exactly. I think it's always important to support Africans to solve their own problems, and it's important all the programmings that when they're coming up with the programmings, we have a bottom up programming, but not to bring a concept that per se would work in America, and you think it would work to Africa, African,
or even impose things in Africa that they wouldn't dare to impose in the United States, such as one of the things that has come out of the Christian evangelical movement in Uganda has been the promotion of homophobic laws, the so-called "Kill the Gays" bill, that alerted the Uganda is known for that, sadly. The work that you've done. How can our audience support the work that you do? I personally find this whole idea of financial solidarity is a very important thing, when particularly there are organizations that say, we don't need your ideas, but, you know, we'll take your money, because that way we can empower ourselves and make the decisions about how to use that money, right?
Yeah. I think, like the model we're using requires very small amounts of money, like a donation of $50 that could be maybe a lunch for somebody. $50, between $50 and $100, we give out a loan to a woman, a businesswoman who is starting a business. And the idea, which is very, very important, on average, the family in Uganda is having five people. So when you support this one woman, you've supported five.
And that woman could go and start her own business, or could even join politics.
Exactly. She can start up that business, and then the proceeds go directly to their families. You know, they treat their children, they pay their school fees, you know. So it means that we're going to have a better future.
And these are Ugandan-run programs, which is key.
Exactly.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Bukenya, for joining us today and sharing some the information about the work that you do and the model that you're using. Best of luck to you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. And give out a website for your organization.
Yeah, our website is www.vacnet.org.
V-A-C-N-E-T.org. We'll post that to our website later today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. My guest, Bukenya Musa, is the founder and program director of in Northern Uganda of an organization called the Volunteer Action Network, vacnet.org. This is Uprising. Anna Buss is our assistant producer and technical director. Christian Beck is our production coordinator. Teddy Robinson is our audio engineer. Special thanks to Jonathan Alexander for technical assistance. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. I'll see you next time. We'll